Unions have a big influence in this country when you consider that the Congress passed a special bill to make sure that railroad employees didn't go on strike. How did unions get such an influence in this country? And are they a good idea in the first place? Welcome to The Conquering Truth. I'm Dan Horn.
I'm Jonathan Seitz.
I'm Charles Churchill.
And I'm Joshua Horn.
So in a very divided America, where you see that the unions currently mostly support the Democratic Party, and they've always, you know, since at least the last 100 and 150 years, that unions have been associated with socialism and communism. So should Christians just completely reject the idea of unions, or is there a place for unions?
So, I mean, I think the short answer is there probably is a place for them in the world, but there are a lot of aspects to unions. I mean, it's, you know, when you think about a union today, they're pretty fully formed in the sense that they've kind of become established as to kind of how they tend to operate, their relationship with the government. But they've had a long history, and there have been different drivers that have caused them to come into existence at different times. There have been different roles that they filled at different points in history. And some of the aspects of unions are perfectly acceptable. Even as unions are today, there are certain aspects of them that biblically or morally, there's nothing wrong with. But I think you do have to kind of go through and not just say, you can't just say unions are fine. You kind of have to go through and talk about specifics and talk about specific aspects of them and think about it. And in the end, I think that's what this episode is really going to be, is kind of pulling them apart and saying, how should you think about unions properly?
I think a lot of people that would classify themselves as conservatives immediately go, unions are terrible.
Right.
And I do think that the way that unions are in this country right now, that's a pretty valid statement. Unions are terrible. I mean, they have a lot of connection to organized crime. They have a lot of connection with corruption and bribery. And, I mean, it's a really bad system. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't a place where they could be useful. But obviously, I think it's obvious that they've gotten out of the place where they're actually useful.
I grew up, the view I had was if you were in a union, you were just going straight to hell. You know, it's been really, even as we were starting to do this episode, peeling apart and thinking about specific aspects of it and accepting the fact that unions aren't just horrible all the way through and just evil, you know, pure evil, was kind of difficult for me, because in the end, like you said, I mean, from a political point of view, if you grew up Republican or you grew up in certain areas, particularly in the South, you know, that you were going to have just an absolute no, unions are bad.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing that is very, you know, regional too, because I was talking to someone a little while ago who was from, you know, somewhere up, they're from Chicago. And they're saying, oh, yeah, it's, you know, all the, I think it was the plumbers up there. They're unionized and they do such good work. Down here, they're horrible. I'm like, wow, that's, and they were on the conservative side of things.
Right. It's
like, that's kind of surprising, because most people don't have that impression of union work.
Because it's interesting, because like when I grew up, you know, I grew up in the Northeast and went to college in New York. And I thought, where I went to college in New York, people went, unions are horrible. Even though it was New York is pretty heavily unionized. But I mean, I remember when I was growing up that my father worked for a trucking company and the Teamsters went on strike, and they had all independent operators, meaning that each person owned their own truck, which meant that they weren't part of the union, because to be part of the union, you have to be an employee. If you're an owner operator, you weren't part of the union. And the union would actually sit at the clover leaves coming off of highways, and they would shoot at the drivers that went by because they have to slow down as they go around the curve. And so, like, the drivers that, you know, worked for the company that my father worked for, they were getting shot at. So, obviously, growing up, my attitude was unions are just evil.
Well, that seems fair.
It does seem, yeah. And I think we forget how much violence is associated with it.
Right.
And I think that's why it's even worthwhile to kind of walk back to and look at some of the history of unions, because they didn't just come on fully formed.
Right. They didn't start off with the authority and the power that they have today.
And the reality is they start off the other way, because – and this ties to – I think we talked a little bit about this on the police episode. But what kind of happens in America and all throughout the world is, with the industrial age, you actually get a greater consolidation of wealth than you had before. You can have somebody like J.P. Morgan or somebody like Carnegie or somebody, you know, Rockefeller. You have these people that all of a sudden – before that, you didn't have the corporations that you could have a mass of people, that all of a sudden you have 30,000 people working for one person, unless they were a king, right? Because kings are always the exception there. And so all of a sudden you have this consolidation of money on, like, just a limited number of individuals. And all of a sudden they have all this money. And guess what? Politicians want money. And so all of a sudden the workers were not being protected by the government. So it wasn't unusual for a company to beat up their workers if their workers were complaining about the money. They would just – it's called a goon squad. I mean, that's where that term comes from. They were goons. They were illiterate, you know, lugs that basically they would go and hire them, and then they'd just beat up the workers. And the government, because they didn't want to offend these people that had very deep pocketbooks, they didn't want to stop them because they would offend the people that were basically – you know, because of the boss system. I don't know how much you know about the boss system, but that's how most people got elected in the 19th century in the U.S., is that you have these conglomerations of wealth, and then they basically pick somebody, or they are behind somebody who then ends up appointing everybody, like even Truman, right? I mean, Truman was he was appointed until he ran for president or vice president. He was basically appointed by the boss system. It wasn't because of his talents or anything else. It's because he knew the guy who was deciding who would be senator from Kansas. And so with that, you get that chain. And so that's where all of a sudden the workers are saying, well, all the authorities are against us. The employer's against us. The government's against us. And so they banded together. And when you hear that part, you have to go, or at least I have to go, well, that's not inherently bad.
Right.
They're trying to protect themselves. What's inherently bad is the government wasn't protecting them.
There's a couple things that are important to kind of pull out of that. One is, you know, it wasn't even just that they were getting beat up at times. I mean, in the times it was that, I mean, there were people who died. I mean, there were people who were losing their life because of this. And so it took a lot. It took a great deal for people to get to the point to be willing to do these things. I mean, because at the end, from their perspective, it was to some degree a life and death struggle. And so there's this part of it where, I mean, when I think if you go back and look at it, it's really easy to paint it kind of as, oh, it was just this disagreement between the employees and this was, and the other part is just like you said, just the lawlessness of it, where the government should have been, the government has a role. The government should be prosecuting someone who's sending the people in to beat up their workers. And if the government's failing to do this, what happens? And where do people turn to? And people do have authority. People actually do have authority to protect their life. And so, I mean, you if you want to fight against this, where do you go in Scripture to fight against it?
Fight against what?
The idea that they can band together and do this. I mean, if you want to say they shouldn't have been able to do this, where do you go to suggest that? You know, where do you go to say, no, people shouldn't be able to do
right.
that?
And, you know, at its you know, barest minimum, it's the union idea, is the idea that people can – you know, work together and say, I'm not going to accept the conditions of employment, whether it's that you're breaking your agreement with me or whether it's that, you know, the amount I'm paying isn't what I deserve for what I'm doing, and that they can get together and say, hey, let's all quit and refuse to work until we're given what we're asking for. And, you know, you see this at a very base level, you know, sometimes, you know, where you know, all the employees of McDonald's quit because of poor working conditions, and so people go to McDonald's and it's closed. Of one particular McDonald's, not like a nationwide thing, but you know, and that's a basic idea. You know, that's not, they haven't formally unionized, but you know, the fundamental thing was we're not accepting how things are, and we're not going to work until things change.
And you know, also with this, you know, consolidation of industry, you get all these company towns where your house is provided, the place that you buy food is provided for. I mean, it's like you don't have any way to escape. And then if you do anything, that people rise up and beat you up. I mean, it's you know, now we're looking back and the people at McDonald's can just go, no, we're going to stop. And they stop working because it's too dangerous or whatever. Starbucks, that happens all the time. I think in New York City, like, you know, a dozen have closed this year just because it's too dangerous. And all the employees go, we're not going to work there. But you look at what it was like then, where you're working 12-hour days, 6 days a week, where you're living in a company house. They basically were reestablishing slavery without actually buying the people. And that has all kinds of problems. And that's essentially what they did. And so they said, we have the right to beat them.
Right.
And it's kind of the equivalent might be, you know, some of these migrant workers where maybe they bring them in from Mexico illegally, or maybe they bring them in and take their passport and say, you now work for us until we decide that you're done working for us. Where basically all of their, you know, choice in how things are going in their life is taken away.
And so we look at it, we look at unions now and go, well, they don't have those situations. But we also need to recognize that, I mean, there were real things that they started with. I mean, again, like you said, people were willing to risk their lives. There was the Homestead Strike, which was outside of Pittsburgh at a plant, and literally got to the point where they were killing each other, and they sent in the military and broke it up. And then the military participated in beating up the workers too. And that still didn't, like, shift everything to cause people to go, wait a second, we need to protect the workers more, because the government was very much in the pocket of you know, of these bosses. And the boss
when
system.
You say protect the workers, specifically what you mean is they should have the right not to be beaten or be killed.
Right.
I mean, they should have the same right that anyone else has, that no one should be able to come over and just start beating you because they want to.
And you know, and it's pretty messy history, because it goes both ways too, where, you know, you're talking about people getting shot at. I mean, that because
the Homestead Strike, the workers were shooting too.
Right. So you know, it's a long and complicated history that we're not going to give you the final answer on in a, you know, 2-minute summary. But, you know, and so there's definitely wrongs going both directions, where people say, well, because I am going to refuse and I'm going to go on strike and say we're not going to work till this is fixed, and therefore no one else can work either, and we'd rather kill them than have them work. Cause
right. Like that was in the 80s, that I remember that, or late 70s. But I do think the bottom line with this is that a lot of the reasons that unions became what they were was the civil magistrate failed to do what it was supposed to do. Right? I mean, it says in Leviticus 19:15, you shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty. In righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. And a lot of it, the original union, you know, establishment, was because the government was saying the rich are a lot more important than the poor.
And I think, you know, if you're looking at the idea of union and striking and this type of thing, that there's a part of it where it doesn't necessarily require you know, violence against the employees, or, you know, breaking contract with them. You know, the Bible says that a workman's worthy of their hire, and there are points where, you know, because the industry is controlled by, you know, a few people, that they might have a lot of power to coerce people legally. In you know, American law, U.S. law, where they're able to coerce people to work below their hire, and that there would be a place for people to say, well, I'm not willing to do this, and let's all not be willing to do this because we are worthy of our hire.
And related to that is the idea of exposure, right? Ephesians 5:11 says, do not partake of the hidden works of darkness, but rather expose them. Where you have an employer that's actually abusing, oppressing the weak, you actually have, I would say, not even the right to, you even have the responsibility to, right? We're supposed to rebuke the oppressor. There's a point where you go, this company is actually doing really, they're taking advantage of people that can't protect themselves. And you don't do this with violence, you do it with exposure. And so there's a real valid place in my mind for unions where they're exposing things that are done in the workplace that are not good. And unfortunately, they don't do that much anymore. But when they started, that's a lot of what they did, was they went, this isn't right. You know, you shouldn't have 5-year-olds working where there's a bunch of rats running around, right? I mean, these are some of the things that were exposed. I mean, it's not like minor things. It's like things that we would, you know, that we would look at and go, that's horrible. But that was just what they were accustomed to, and nobody knew anything about it.
There is a part of it where, as you think about this, and it goes far in history, you can shame people for things that are perfectly reasonable practices. I mean, you know what I mean? And
sure.
and this is sort of where, as you see unions go along, so there was a point where they were saying, we're being beaten, and you shouldn't be allowed to be beaten. But there's another point where it's like, they say, will you work for this amount? And the person says, yes, I'll work for this amount. And they have an agreement, and the employer meets his agreement. And then they go, wait a minute, I don't want to work for this anymore. This isn't an amount that I want to continue working for, and I don't want to go find another job. In fact,
because nobody will pay me more.
Right. And so I'm going to try to find a way to shame you and tell, you know, and so there's a part of it where, because of, you know, so there is a part, as you look at this, you know, just because something is presented as shameful, and often what happens is it's a one-sided expose. They'll expose, do you realize what we have to do in this job? And on the other side, the boss if you actually understood the nature of this particular work, if you understood the risks that the boss was taking on, if you understood the fact that there's days where they don't do work and he has to pay them. You know what I mean? There's people don't understand that. And so there are situations where, you know, you can have an imbalance of how things are exposed or an ignorance about things that causes someone to look at it and go, that's unreasonable, when in reality it's very reasonable.
And I think, though, when you look to begin with, right, you have a Carnegie, right, who was the owner of the steel,
right,
you know, the steel plant that with the Homestead strike, I mean, this is Carnegie has a huge amount of power, and he has control over you know, lots of media and everything else. And to some extent the unions also are saying we want to equalize our ability to speak, because nobody would listen to,
right,
you know, a guy, you know, just a normal steel worker compared to Carnegie. Everybody's going to listen to Carnegie. Nobody's going to listen to the steel worker. But if you have a bunch of steel workers together, then the media starts to pay attention to them.
Right.
So some of the whole thing about the unions in the first place was to equalize some of that, because there was a lot of one-sided press, basically. And the other thing is that, you know, there's one thing to say we're going to stop the, you know, the employer shouldn't have the right to say we're going to stop the employee from leaving. He has to work for us.
Right.
But the employee shouldn't be able to say we're going to stop the employer from employing other people.
Right.
Right. I mean, those are parallel, and that should be, you know, both of those should be true. And the problem is neither one wants that to be true. They both want the law to favor them and not to be equitable.
One of the things we should really point out here is unions in a lot of ways are the nature of, because it began because the government wasn't doing what's right. This is what happens in almost every situation. Someone sins, and because of their sin, it causes other people to have to do things that they normally should not have to do, and things don't get back into balance. It's not that them doing that all of a sudden causes the government to go, oh, you're right, we should have been taking care of this. Now people go, hey, there's another way to have power. And people begin pursuing power through alternate means. And so there's this part of, I mean, in this, you can see this just throughout history where things get out of whack, and now you come forward 100 years, 200 years later, and that imbalance has continued to grow, and the nature of that battle has continued to be waged and tipped back and forth.
At one point you had company owners had all this influence with the politicians and were basically controlling them. And then eventually you get that the unions are so big and they have so much government protection that they end up having a lot of influence with the politicians. And they kind of became this corrupt political system that at one point they were trying to eliminate.
Right. And I mean, when you think about it, right, politicians don't want money. What they want is votes. And so the reason that they would, you know, show favoritism towards these rich people was so that they could get money from them so that they could get votes, right? So that they could advertise. Once you get the unions, and the unions have a lot more votes than the rich people that own the corporations have. And so the power and who's controlling the government shifts, because instead of going, we want the money that we can use to get votes, what we'll do is we'll just take the votes directly and then we'll get money from the government, basically, right, is how it works. And so that's where you see the shift, is once it's unionized, the politicians, instead of saying, now we should be just and equitable, instead what they say is, hey, there's where all the votes are. That's how I'll get elected. So then they shifted their allegiance from going after or going with the robber barons, the so-called robber barons, which, you know, that term was like coined at this time. And they started to shift to go with the unions because that's where the votes are.
And so then you have a bunch of, you know, a ton of different laws that, you know, some are quite old and some are a lot newer, regulating how unions operate. So it's not just this simple thing of, well, all the workers saying, let's not endure these conditions anymore. And then, you know, the market, you know, are there people who are willing to do it? It doesn't work like that. Because there's, you know, a lot of law upon law upon law that is governing how all that stuff works.
So, I mean, sometime in the past year, we had a conversation going, if you were going to try to outlaw unions, how could you do it? And pretty much any law you could make to outlaw unions would end up trampling on some right that people should have. You know what I mean? Because there was this part of it where, I mean, you know what I mean? There were so many, I mean, it was hard to just come in and go, oh, if you just do this, I mean, what it requires is it requires people to be moral. You know what I mean? It requires the government to do its job. It requires people to do their job. It requires people to do to be committed. If they make an agreement, that they fulfill it.
The power that the unions have is from the government. I mean, that's right. What they're given their power to do. You know, because there's, and it depends, you know, non-right to work states, you have to pay money to the union whether you want to or not if your company votes to become a union shop. And so you don't have a choice. The government has given them the power, the union the power to force you to be in the union.
And part of this is, I mean, you kind of have to take a step back towards another historical thread, which is, you know, the idea of voluntary associations. Voluntary associations in the United States is a big deal. It actually had a huge influence.
What do you mean by voluntary associations? What's under that
umbrella? That's Benjamin Franklin's term, where he basically said what you need to do is you need to get the people to organize to do things that should be done together. Because it's not the role of the government to – it's not the role of government. One of the first ones he did was to create a fire department. It's not the role of the government to create a fire department. The people that have houses there, they should get together and they should all say, hey, we'll chip in, you know, a dollar a piece, and then we'll – you know, from this, we'll have protection. We should have.
And he was starting off with there being no fire department. And like, right. Hey, we need a fire department.
And back then, a dollar was right. A lot.
and so he did this, like, this is how libraries started. This is how the American Philosophical Society started. That's another thing that he started as a voluntary association. What he said is that the way to actually change things is to get a group of people that all go, this should change, and get them to go to get together and do it and cause it to happen. And this isn't like, you know, a new idea that Franklin came up with. This was actually in the late 17th century. This the king at the time, and I forget which king it is, but he basically saw the moral decay that was happening in the country of
which
of
country?
England.
Okay.
It had gotten that drunkenness was, you know, prostitution, everything. It had just the whole culture of the nation became kind of like modern America. And so it was that bad. And so the king said, we really need to do something. And so he passed a bill about the Reformation of Manners. But the way that it was actually implemented was he got groups of people together and that they could, very much like the Texas law about abortion, they could sue people that were doing these things that were evil. And so that they could bring it to court so the government wasn't doing it. And by that, because there were interested parties that gathered together, which is like ACLU. I mean, it's like whatever the other one is, ACJ.
Oh, I was thinking of the Southern Poverty Center, but I was, yeah.
No. But all these are the same thing. These are all voluntary associations where, like, you know, the Anti-Defamation League. It's too hard to do it individually, but if a bunch of us get together, then we can do it.
Right.
And so America very much was built off of this, but that like ended up like really changing England. And that's how Wilberforce, right? That's how Wilberforce, that was one of the main things that he did to get the attitude of England to change so that the slave trade got abolished. I mean, that was the first thing that he did was actually go back and do the same thing that was happened at the end of the 17th century, have it do it again in the middle of the 18th. I'll get my centuries right. And so, you know, this idea, and so this is what Franklin's doing, and it's bringing it here, but it was much more embraced in the U.S. than any place else in the world. Because you look at Red Cross, you look at
the
all
March
these
of Dimes,
things, the March of Dimes, you look at, these all go back to Franklin's
Lions,
voluntary.
Lions, Clubs, Civic, right. all of those sort of ancillary.
Right, where they go, we don't have authority, but we have something that we think is important that we're all going to associate together. It's voluntary, which was
influence.
A really important thing because when you talk about right to work, that's basically saying unions should be voluntary associations rather than involuntary associations, which is basically what they functionally are in a lot of the heavily unionized states.
And we should take a minute. I mean, I remember I did not realize there was such a thing. I remember hearing somebody say, like a politician say when I was about, I don't know, 15 or something, right to work is not right for this state. And I remember going, I couldn't imagine that being a positive slogan. You know what I mean? I remember like going, and I was like asking, what does that mean? And they're like, oh, if you're not in a union, you can't have a job. You can't be hired. You have to be in a union to get a job. And I remember
at that place.
Right. And but I was like, I just remember being, to me, like, if you were in America, that couldn't be true. that was like antithetical. You know what I mean?
That's because you grew up in the South.
Right, right. No, I understand that. But I just mean I remember that being just completely shocked that that existed anywhere in the United States. But that's been true in places for – that was true in places for a very long time. It's less true and now than it used to
be. Right, but I'm sure there are still some states. But basically, I think like Indiana became right to work. And so then all of a sudden Michigan and Illinois are looking at them and going, wait a second, all the companies are moving to Indiana and they're not – it's right. actually more convenient. You have the lakes to move things and with and stuff. So it's actually more convenient to be in Illinois or Michigan, but yet Indiana was outperforming them. And so all of a sudden those states started to go, we need to do it, which are the most heavily unionized states.
Because, I mean, when they're saying we cannot have right to work in our state, they're saying, guys, if we make everyone join the union, we can make the bosses give us more money. We can coerce them to force them to – you know, more money or, you know, non-monetary benefits. We can make them do this.
Right.
Even though people will work for less, let's not let them hire those people.
And so, I mean, we were kind of talking about the history, but there was a point where it, like, really shifted. Because even Wilson was very anti-union. Like, very anti-union. And I think of Wilson being very progressive, you know, very, you know, socialist.
Right.
And but yet he was still very anti-union. But at that point, people still saw their power base as being the, you know, these robber barons, these rich guys. And so because of that, he was still very anti-union and hadn't made the shift, even though he was a socialist in a lot of ways.
And, I mean, the reason why people were anti-union was because the unions also, when they went on strike, could have major problems. Like, the, you know, if you have the railroads go on strike or the coal miners go on strike and you're getting in the winter, you know, if you remember, you know, was it last year or the year before, but when Texas had the big cold freeze and people lost power, well, they're saying, like, people are going to die. So, you know, if you have that going into winter, you're not going to have any coal to heat your houses to cook your food. You know, you're the president. You're like, well, if this happens, you know, people are going to be dying. It's going to be really bad. So, you know, there's some regulation that is helping the unions, and there's some that's to restrain them because they were saying this is actually what you're going to do is going to harm people.
And so, like when you get to 1928, that's kind of the battle, right, is that you have on the one hand that if they go on strike, the railroad workers in particular, because that was the first one that they started to pass laws about. And, you know, in England, it was all the coal miners because it was the same kind of issues, you know, and it was all Churchill and the coal miners and how do you, when they go on strike and everybody, all of a sudden, all the factories are shut down and everybody's out of work and you can't heat your homes anymore, what do you do? And so, you know, Churchill was the, you know, Secretary of Labor, the English equivalent at the time. And in the U.S., it was really the railroads because we have to ship things longer distances. And so, you know, they basically, the Railroad Act, and I think it was 28, they basically said, you know, we give you certain rights, but we take away rights on the other side because they didn't want to lose the votes of all those railroad workers. But at the same time, they didn't want people to be cold because then if people were cold, then they would vote against them because, like you said, the example of Texas.
Is that the first legislation regulating unions?
That's the first major one. I think there were some minor ones before that, but that's the first one where they're really saying, well, we'll give you certain rights, but we'll give the corporation certain rights. And they started to give rights beyond what people had naturally, right? Because you have the natural right to say, I want to hire you. You have the natural right to say, I want to work for you. But all of a sudden, the government's saying, we're
natural
third
right
party
not
in that.
To want to be beaten.
Right. And now all of a sudden the government's saying we're going to step in there. And that's even, I think it was based on that bill that when, you know, President Biden could force the railroads to go into negotiations with the unions, which is what he did in August of this year. And then, you know, and then there came out that the thing, the agreement, that because it's forced mediation is what the bill requires. And then when the three of the unions refused to accept it, basically they passed a law and said, you're accepting this, and the railroad workers are not allowed to go on strike because it's considered treason, basically. It's seen as attacking America.
Not knowing the history of it, but the way that you're telling that kind of a story, it sounds like that's a point in time, at least, where something significant is happening and that the government is, if you will, creating unions as a political entity. As a governmental entity, almost, even though it's not a branch of the government. But when you start regulating something like that, then all of a sudden it's not just the voluntary association of people who are trying to avoid abuses.
And at that moment, you know, you kind of have the president or Congress, you know, having to make the decision of, am I going to step in? And you also have the allure of power saying, well, I see a problem. The government can fix it. And it, I mean, it's easy to, you know, Monday morning quarterback and because they were faced with real, you know, difficult situations of, are people going to be freezing to death? But, you know, there definitely is an attraction to say, we can solve this. We're going to take control. We're going to establish this, that, and the other bureaucracy to make sure that they come to an equitable agreement, you know, and seizing power that arguably is not theirs to be seized. And not doing things that perhaps they could be doing, which is to say, you know, we're going to enforce peace. We're going to say, if people want to come work for these companies, the unions cannot attack them and, you know, stop them. People can go work without fear, breaking the strike by new workers coming in, and to not let the, you know, the, and to enforce, you know, the rights that everyone, the workers who are on strike, should have to be to not be, you know, being oppressed in illegal ways by their bosses. But it was very attractive to say, well, let's make a simple fix and just get this problem solved by seizing more power.
And part of it is, they created the problem somewhat too, because they gave special rights to corporations, because we're talking about the unions as being this new political entity, but there was already a new political entity, which was the corporation.
That the government had created.
And so now they're creating unions kind of to counterbalance what they had already done with corporations. And none of these are biblical, right? I mean, none of these, to give the power to it. It's nothing wrong with a group of people getting together and saying that we're going to do business. There's nothing wrong with partnerships. That's in the Bible. You see that. You know, Peter was in a partnership. You see that idea. But then all of a sudden the corporation is the idea that the government can create a new entity, a new political entity. And then they do exactly the same thing with unions.
So what rights was the government giving to corporations that was causing issues that the unions were fighting against?
Well, I mean, the corporations, again, you're back to, there were corporate towns. They controlled all the everything that came in and went out of the towns. I mean, they had real power, and that they were it's even like Disney in Orlando, Florida, yeah, where they were the political entity as well. And so they became, the government let them basically be a separate political entity with some of these large corporations.
Right, but if you're, you know, if you have a mine, if you own a piece of property that's a gold mine, and then you build housing and you build a store and you invite workers to come across the country,
Can't you kill those workers whenever you want to?
No, but you kind of have that corporate town, and it could just be one rich guy who owns this gold mine.
Right, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's when you start to restrict it, when you start to, the only way in and out of that town is on your corporate, you know, that's the only access to it. When the only place that you can buy food is from the corporate store, so the corporate store starts to raise the prices, this is where you start to have much more of a problem, is where they're allowing that to act as a government entity.
That they sell justice to them as well, effectively.
Yes.
But, I mean, and as opposed to the fact, right, it's not wrong that they're there and they're operating, but the law can't be different there. The law, you can't cease to be having certain rights and those rights being recognized.
And that's kind of where they went. And again, it's not that that's inherent to a corporation, but because of the depravity of man, maybe it is inherent to a corporation, but it's not inherent to the idea of setting up a corporation.
Because it also indemnified them. It also was a shield in the sense of, now you couldn't persecute, you couldn't necessarily prosecute specific individuals with certain things, because this is part of what the corporation did, is it was also a shield for those individuals. The corporation did this, not the individual did this. And so now you're doing, now evil isn't being done by someone, it's being done by this something, and the government created that something.
You shifted the object of where justice and responsibility lie. It's
right.
Not with a person anymore. Which, everything you read in the Bible about who's responsible for something, it's either a person or a collections of persons as a nation. But now we're adding in this business entity thing.
It's, yeah, and that's probably worth doing a whole episode just on corporations, because in the effect of the shift from the household to the corporation is a big, has a really huge impact. But, you know, the parallel is, like you said, is that creating unions, you're kind of doing the same thing again, where you're giving power to a group of people just because they banded together. Well, the power that's given to a group of people because they banded together is supposed to be a civil government, right? I mean, that's what nations are. It's not the union shouldn't have that power, but they effectively get that power. You can work, you can't work.
The perspective that we're kind of approaching it from is, I mean, probably pretty, you know, free market, that it's voluntary, you know, and that the, you know, when you look at it from the economic perspective, that if the union has, you know, if they are being underpaid, then, you know, the market will favor them, and that there won't be workers who show up, and so they'll get their jobs back because the company will cave. And if they're making unreasonable demands, then they're going to lose their jobs because other people are going to come in. But I think when you look scripturally, there is kind of another level to it, because there are people who take, you know, the libertarian, you know, idea that is not only is the free market and supply and demand and this type of thing a way to describe how the world works, but it's also a moral principle that because the world works this way, therefore it's a good thing that it's doing. But, you know, the scripture talks a lot about not oppressing the poor. You have verses like Zechariah 7, 9 through 10. Thus says the Lord of hosts, execute true justice, show mercy and compassion everyone to his brother. Do not oppress the widow or the fatherless, the alien or the poor. Let none of you plan evil in his heart against his brother. And so to a certain point, justice is enforcing the laws. But when you're talking about mercy and compassion and oppression, there's ways that you can oppress people legally. You know, in ancient Israel, there are ways you could oppress people legally. They weren't violating their specific laws that God had given. You weren't stealing from them, but you were not showing them the kindness that you ought to. So there's a point where you can have a big corporation or a really rich guy that is oppressing people and is causing people to suffer. And the right response might not be for the government to say, we're going to pass this, that, and the other law to stop you from doing this. But the right thing might be to say, you know, you are sinning against your brother. This is very wrong what you're doing. And, you know, you kind of have the social, you know, and I mean, obviously, you know, biblical rebuke, and then the social pressure of saying what you're doing is wrong, and it's not, and it's causing these bad consequences.
And it operates on a few different levels there, right? Because these are corporations that they're getting their power because they're able to sell things. The way that you can actually reduce the power of a corporation to be able to oppress people, I mean, you do what Sinclair Lewis did, and he started to publish about what the meatpacking industry was like, and all of a sudden the meatpacking industry has to change because people are going, I don't want to buy that meat,
right?
And so you can, by exposing, they are very, very much subject to other people. If people go, I'm not going to buy a car from Ford because they're doing such and such, then guess what? Ford will change their policies, which is, you know, you see that all the time, especially with the homosexual movement, because they're very good at it, at threatening corporations so that they panic. They do things that are very foolish and very against the word of God and very against what works in the world, but they do it because they're afraid that a group of people will say, we're not going to use you. The problem with that is that takes time, and politicians hate the idea of things taking time. Because they want to fix it now, because
they've
every day that it goes
years.
On, right? And every day that it goes on, it looks worse for them. And because we've become such a society that wants immediate gratification, the reality is a place that has it restricted like that, the seeds of its own destruction are planted in there. It's not that sustainable. But it could last 10 years, but the politicians aren't willing to let it last 10 years, where you then get a balance where it's equitable. Instead, what they say is you need to pass a law so you create a new entity and then give this power and then give this power. And it spirals out of control is what happens over and over again. And mostly it's just the lack of patience. And the reason the government has a lack of patience is the people have a lack of patience. The reality, monopolies, we can talk all we want about, oh, you can cancel and you have Twitter and you have. But the reality is if they start doing that, other things spring up. As long as the government's just, other things will spring up. And I'm not saying perfectly just, but I'm saying if you're not like Russia where you
or
have
even
Pravda.
Even if they just try to do it a little bit.
Right. But if you don't have Pravda is the only, you know, media, if you allow other medias, and if you – then other things will spring up. You look at CNN. CNN dominated the market. And then Fox News comes along and says we'll be fair and balanced, and whether they are or not, you can debate. But the reality is CNN's almost gone now.
Right.
And we just have to have patience to be willing to wait the 10 years that it takes.
everything in our country has been dominated by the fact of what you're saying about the fact that we're not willing to wait. I mean, it's what goes on with the money supply and with the Federal Reserve. We're not interested in letting the economy balance itself out. So the Federal Reserve comes along and they pull the thing back and forth, and you go from recession to record profits to recession to record profits. And so, I mean, it's really important to bring this back to, it's about sin. It is about the sin of man. It is about our unwillingness to recognize that God is sovereign and that God has defined a way of dealing with these things. And I think, there are people who just need to stop and take a minute and go, can they see their – I mean, this, if you're sitting at home and you're listening to this and you're looking at the world, you should sit back and go, I'm part of the problem here. I'm impatient. I don't want to wait for things. I don't want to do what's right. I don't want this to be fixed the way God's designed it to be fixed.
And if we're talking about sins, I mean, some sins that are, very clearly on display is where it's, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And I mean, that's pretty core to either side, right, of the union issues, where you have companies that love money more than they love their fellow men, and you have workers who love money more than they love justice and their fellow men.
Right.
We've been talking about in the case of the unions and the corporations, how they get involved and it just makes things worse. I mean, it's also worthwhile just commenting on the Federal Reserve. You used to have depressions. There were bad depressions in the 19th century. And they would almost all last less than a year. Because, the natural process writes itself pretty quickly, typically. And actually, then the growth comes faster. But, you then have, like with the Great Depression, you have FDR get involved and you have this shift of power to the Fed and all this other stuff. And then it lasts for 10 years. When man thinks we can come in and fix things by doing unjustly, we just prolong the pain. And that's what happens over and over again. And I think that's what you see with the unions.
And specifically when you say by doing unjustly, relevant to this conversation is the unjust exercise of authority. It's taking authority where authority doesn't belong and giving it somewhere.
Right. It's creating a new entity that you give authority to, which is what happened, in 1935 with the National Labor Relations Act. Because in the National Labor Relations Act, it made the federal government that if employees sued their employer, the federal government would pay for part of the cost. So then all of a sudden now, if you're an employer, you have to foot the bill. But if you're an employee, then the government will foot the bill for you, for a union, not for an individual. So even though we look at unions and you see how many billions of dollars that unions have, the government, the way they have billions of dollars is that the government is the one that was funding these things and helping them do these things. So that was one part of the bill. Another was that if they voted to be unionized, that they had to deal with the collective bargaining. They had to deal with the union. They weren't allowed to say, we're just doing it with individual employees anymore. Now they had to, if the shop was decided to be unionized, they're now an equal partner. They're an equal created entity, just like the corporation was. And then you couldn't be fired for participating in strikes if you said that the working conditions were unfair, or there were unfair labor practices. So the
oh, what a threshold there.
But that's why you get things like when they go on strike, they don't just go on strike for money. Because if a union goes on strike for money, they're allowed to fire them. But if the union goes on strike and says, they're torturing us because we don't have sick days, that's an unfair labor practice, then they can't fire them. So you hear about their health insurance isn't good enough. You hear about they don't get enough sick days. They don't get enough vacation days. That's all unfair labor practices. So that's how they stop themselves from being fired. Because if they'd said this is purely economic, which any employer knows, hey, it's all economics. You give somebody an extra vacation day, that's an economic thing. That is not right. Unfair labor practice, but these are the things that they throw in because they created these other categories, which means that now all of a sudden all these corporations have to worry about healthcare and they have to worry about paid leave of absence and the vacations. Instead of saying this is the deal that I have with my employees, all of a sudden they have to do these things because otherwise And so now the government's created this whole infrastructure of stuff that's in business that really doesn't belong in business.
I mean, that seems like it moved really quickly to go from the government, in a sense, creating unions as political entities in 1928. By 1935, it's all of them, and it's more laws, more rules, more protections, more subsidization of it. You know, in just 7 years, I mean, that's really quick.
But remember what's happening in Europe. This is the rise of fascism. This is, you know, this is all the stuff, the socialism that's going on and growing up in Europe. So we're just trying to match
that with Americans Europe. Were very attracted by until yes. Hitler.
Yeah. So when we think of socialism, when we think of communism, we usually tie that back to Marx, and that, you know, it is the idea of a society rather than an individual. In a subset of that society, the workers, the proletariat, they're the people that make up the unions, basically. So right. it is coming from that idea. But the shift of power, it used to be, right, Marx is saying it's the man against the workers. And now it becomes the man being the government, which is the entity that God created, with the workers against the corporations in a lot of cases.
Right.
Until the corporation gets big enough that they want to keep them on their side again, which is why you see the unions and large corporations are very pro-Democrat and have been for a long time.
Right.
And small businesses are anti-Democrat because they're not in that circle. If that makes sense. So yeah. That's created this division in the country. And that's why you're even seeing the shift in the division as the blue-collar workers are less and less unionized. They shift more towards the Republicans because these other people are saying what we should do is get close to the power so that we can wield the power, whether we're unions or whether we're corporations. You know, the other side is saying, no, we should just let us be free.
You kind of went through a list of some things that kind of came out of unions. And I think it's useful to kind of run back through a couple of them real quick and look at with the perspective of all of these things would be fine if you didn't do them unjustly. Like where the government says it'll pay for the cost of the union to sue the employee. There's nothing wrong with an employee suing his boss. And in fact, there's even nothing wrong with the imbalance of power to say that if he loses, then maybe even the boss, if the boss loses, that he pays for the, you know, that pays for the lawsuit, the cost of the lawsuit. In certain cases, that would be a perfectly reasonable way to balance some of the inequity, is that, you know, so that the person would only sue when they really believe they had a chance at winning. And if you make the courts just, you have, you know, that could be an acceptable way and to handle some of the inequity there.
And some of the ways that works is with a class action lawsuit, right? Because it's that one employee may not be able to spend $1 million to sue their employer.
Right.
But is it reasonable for a group of people to get together a class and right. do that same lawsuit? And then they have the funding because there's enough members of the class to do it. And so then all of a sudden you get that balance, but you can do that by voluntary associations. You don't need to do that by the government coming in and saying that we'll right. fund it.
And, I mean, another part of that, too, is how complicated are the court systems and how expensive are they right. necessarily, where there's no way for you to sue a big corporation because the courts allow them to – you know, make you spend $100,000.
$100,000? You mean $1 million?
Well, whatever. Hundreds and millions and billions of dollars. When, you know, if you have an actual, you know, easily provable issue with them, why does that cost much
I mean,
of anything
I,
at all?
You know, Charles said something earlier in the podcast that keeps sticking with me as being really important, is it all started with somebody sinned. And then we tried to come up with human means of dealing with the inequity of that particular sin. And it has just snowballed and gotten things more and more complicated as we go. And if you think about the outside of church, outside of Christianity, there isn't a good solution for any of these things other than let's just do more. Let's try this. Let's wield the government a different way. Let's change the government. But there's no good solution to any of these problems that start with sin, that start with the dealing with envy that's in the heart of man, dealing with the desire for violence. You know, there's no right solution for any of this other than just the raw exercise of power. And so that's how you get yourself in this kind of complicated mess.
And I mean, I would even assign it to a very specific sin, which is not caring about justice, because that's the sin that the government is doing that causes all these things to happen. And the church now, right, because at least 100 years ago, the church actually had some idea of we need to do justly, right? I mean, Micah 6:8, do justly, love mercy, walk humbly before your God. Doing justly is incredibly important, but the church says now it should be out of the justice business, out of what's saying this is just, this is unjust. And the reality is that's what the church needs to be doing, is shining light to say, no, this is what justice is. But the church is unwilling to do that. And as long as the church is unwilling to do it, everything's just going to get spiraling worse and worse, because there is no sense of justice in the society. You know, well, two men, they love each other just like a man and a woman, so why can't they marry? When the church isn't going, that's not just, because God is the one who created marriage and he is the one that gets to define it. When the church refuses to say that and refuses to declare what justice is, you hear all these false arguments about justice and people get treated very unjustly. And it seems to me that the way the church is supposed to deal with the sin, because it doesn't bring people to repentance, that's the work of the Holy Spirit, but the church has the responsibility to shine the light in the dark places. And as long as the church doesn't talk about justice, the injustice is just going to grow. It doesn't matter how men thrash around. Every time they thrash around, they'll just be accentuating the problem rather than reducing it, because they don't have the knowledge to say this is what it looks like to be just.
Well, and what it will look like is you'll have a problem present and you'll fix that problem, but in fixing that problem, you end up creating a whole new set of problems. And then now you've got to solve those problems, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And now, if you live in a certain state, you can't go work as an electrician unless you join this union. Right. Which is a long way from saying, hey, let's band together so that our boss doesn't beat us.
Right.
And then you get President Biden, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act, where he was giving the unions like $65 billion because the government now feels like they have to bail out the union pension funds because the unions, you know, they had so much money stolen from them because they're, you know, largely criminal organizations. They have a lot of connections to organized crime and stuff, and there's a lot of money that just floats through their hands and disappears. So the federal government comes and bails them out. And so now we just take another step, right? Because now we say we can steal from people to give to these other people because other people stole from them, instead of actually stopping the stealing. You wouldn't want to do that. What you do instead is all these secondary things, and the problem just keeps getting bigger.
I mean, it'd be easy to look at America and say we're a union success story because things are pretty great generally. I mean, there's issues, but things are pretty good. But I don't think that's the right place to assign the good things that have happened from. I mean, plus, things are good in non-union states, too, and non-union companies. But, you know, you look at, I mean, we've talked some in other episodes about, you know, I forget which episode it was, but some of the things in Nigeria, and, you know, they try to unionize, and they try to have the government regulate things. But it doesn't help. It doesn't help, and things are bad there. Because they don't have the, you know, a lot of the foundations that we have and a lot of the, you know, foundations of justice and, you know, the wealth that we have from work ethic and all kinds of different things. So, you know, the government trying to fix the problems there just falls flat on its face.
And I mean, and, you know, some of the ways you just see the inequality too, right? Like in the National Labor Relations Act, they basically said the unions could be monopolies, like the United Auto Workers, but the companies were not allowed to unionize with each other. They could not come to any collective agreement. So the companies have to negotiate individually with the UAW, but the UAW negotiates with all of them, which means that the only place that these companies, because they're not right-to-work states, the only place that these companies can get employees is from the United Auto Workers. And so this creates this disparity that they actually can go to prison if they, like, collude with one another. That's collusion if the companies do it, but if the employees do it. And so this just, again, creates another huge set of problems, which is where you get the $65 billion bailout. It's because, right, you know, otherwise you'd choose a better union than one that's filled with crooks. But when that's the only one, if you want to work in that industry and it's the biggest industry in the state, if that's what you want to work in, guess what? You have to be part of that union.
Because when you look at, like, collective bargaining, the idea of it, as long as it's perfectly voluntary, it balances itself out.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because if you've got a group of people who would say, we're going to band together and we're going to work, and let's say one of them's a really good worker, and the other guys kind of get lazy and they've been banding together. There's a point where the guy who's the really good worker might go and go, you know, I could do the work of all four of these guys, and the boss will, you know what I mean, and or some outside group can do the work of all four of these guys. It balances itself. It completely manages itself.
And what happens is what unions always do, because their power is in numbers, is what they always do is make things not merit-based. And what they do is make things that are just based on seniority. And that's what they always push for. Companies always want to make it merit-based, because if you're successful in making it merit-based, your union will dissolve for the reason you just said.
Right.
Is that if you make stuff merit-based, people will go, I'd rather work harder and get paid more.
Right. And we've all been in a place, you've all walked into places before where you could go, I could do four, you know, I could do four of these people's job, and if they'd pay me twice as much as one of them, I could do four of their jobs, but you know they can't, they don't have the freedom to do that necessarily. You know, some places they do have the freedom to do that, and there are some places where that's exactly what happens. But I mean, you know, I mean, this is the sort of, those are the tensions that keep those things from flying apart.
And now, like, you go to, I mean, I can tell you other stories from when I used to work at General Motors, but my brother worked there, and he worked in a plant. And he said most of the people that had been there at least 10 years, and that was the majority of the people in the plant, they worked at least 80 hours a week, because they would actually sleep on the factory floor, get paid that, and then they would work the 40 hours to actually do their work. And so they ended up getting paid, you know, this was back in the 80s, and they'd get paid $150,000 a year, which was a lot of money back then, because they were basically sleeping, but they got paid for it, and the company couldn't get rid of them. So you go on the factory floor, and there's all these people sleeping everywhere, because if it was merit-based, they'd go, well, you're never getting promoted. Look, we're doing a layoff. Guess what? These guys who all slept, you're never working here again.
Right.
But they can't do that, because there's a monopoly that's enforced by the government. That's you know,
so they literally got paid for the 40 hours of sleeping, and then got overtime for the 40 hours that they
– So they would get 2.5 times their base salary. And that's why U.S. cars were so expensive. So the Japanese come in, and they're much better quality cars for the same price, because they could easily make a much better quality cars because they didn't have the same union.
Because
problems.
We had basically – we had enforced something that would tempt people to be lazy.
And we had made it that we're going, this unions is actually producing better quality stuff, which wasn't true. Because you look at now, you know, BMW is you know, in South Carolina, where it's not unionized.
Right.
And you look at the cars from Detroit, who would say that Detroit cars are better than BMWs? The ones were
probably
union,
Detroit,
but the one's union and the other one's not.
Right.
You can't draw that line to say union workers do better quality work.
And that's the other side of these things. This is, you forget that it actually causes people who weren't corrupt to become more corrupt, or people who were moderately corrupt to become more corrupt. You know what I mean? Whenever you, because basically in a sense you're taking someone, you know, you think of someone who comes and his father tells him, I want you to work hard, I want you to go, and I want you to do these things. And then he goes into this environment, and the environment goes, whoa, 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 slow down. Well, what are you doing? Why are you rushing around? Don't you understand? If you take, you're trying to
us look bad.
I mean, and so you have this person who would have tried to do better, but in fact you're encouraging him to be evil. You're encouraging sin to grow in him, and so it's incredibly corrupt.
Whenever we've talked about laws, rules, standards, we've always talked about it in the sense of, the way that they affect externals is by constraining sin. You're putting up fences that make it hard for somebody to sin.
Right.
And you're saying this is taking those fences down and opening up opportunities to sin where there otherwise would have been constraints, maybe even just the natural constraints of, if I don't work hard, somebody else is going to work hard and I'll lose my job.
Yeah, we're taking down fences and putting exit ramps. Yeah, I mean, it's...
Oh, and you see this where you hire somebody new in a company that's doing more work, and all of a sudden everybody else does more work. I mean, this is like super obvious. This isn't subtle. The next thing that happens with unions in a lot of ways is even worse. Because the next thing that happens with unions is the government starts to be unionized. So where Wilson was against unions, FDR was the one that was pushing for unions, and he was pushing hard for unions. But he also said, you can never do this with the government employees. And so in the famous letter that he printed again, so this was his stated position. All government employees should realize that the process of collective bargaining, as usually understood, cannot be transplanted into the public service. It has its distinct and insurmountable limitations when applied to public personnel management. The very nature and purposes of government make it impossible for administrative officials to represent fully or to bind the employer in mutual discussions with government employee organizations. The employer is the whole people who speak by means of laws enacted by their representatives in Congress. Particularly, I want to emphasize my conviction that militant tactics have no place in the functions of any organization of government employees. Upon employees in the federal service rests the obligation to serve the whole people, whose interests and welfare require orderliness and continuity in the conduct of government activities. This obligation is paramount. Since their own service have to do with the functioning of the government, a strike of public employees manifests nothing less than an intent on their part to prevent or obstruct the operations of government until their demands are satisfied. Such action, looking towards the paralysis of government by those who have sworn to support it, is unthinkable and intolerable.
And it definitely is a bit statist. Like, how dare you go against this, or you know, the sovereign organization that you're sworn to uphold?
Right.
But at the same time, he saw something that was really that with a company, you have they're negotiating with the union, and they also have to sell their product. With the government, it doesn't work that way. They're negotiating with the union, and they have to buy those unions' votes. Right? Because that's the way it works.
Yep.
And so when you think about it, that people vote based on you know, they say, this is my major issue. If the government is the one that's appointing how much you get paid, and that how comfortable your life is, all of a sudden that is your major issue, which means that they can easily buy the votes of 20% of the people whenever they want. And so as soon as those become government employees, they're the ones setting the salary. And so that means that so when I was young, when I, you know, say 1980, in 1980, the average public employee, they would retire after 25 years, and then they would get their salary for the rest of their life. But they made about 70% of what the public sector employees made.
Private sector employees.
Now, the public sector employees make something like 20 to 30% higher. They still only work 25 years, and they still get their full salary after those 25 years. But yet they make far more than the private sector employees do. It makes and they do a lot less work, because the reality is everybody's gone to governments, and governments are not renowned for being efficient, because there's no pressure on them to be efficient. Because if they're efficient, that reduces the number of government or of union members. And all of a sudden, you know, you don't want to reduce the number of union members, because that means you could have fewer votes to buy with raising their pay. And so that's why, like, every gubernatorial election, they talk about giving salary increases to teachers, because they're all voting of who's going to buy their votes. And so when you have the people voting for the people that are negotiating with them, it creates this loop that just causes your cost to spiral out of control. And this is one of the reasons the government is so expensive, is because we've created this feedback loop that it will just continue as long as you have public sector union employees.
But don't you always have that issue as long as you have bureaucracy? Because you're still going to set the teacher's salary whether they're
unionized
or not.
The difference is they're not collective, which means that if I go, you're a good teacher, I'm going to give you a raise. You're a lousy teacher, I'm not going to give you a raise. They're not looking to say, have I negotiated one contract? Because as soon as they negotiate that one contract, now they've said to everybody, we're giving you a 4% raise. Or in the case of the railroad workers, we're giving you a 28% raise, I think it was. Right? I mean, that's what the agreement was. And so all of a sudden, they know that when that governor candidate says, you know, I'm going to give a 4% raise to the teachers, or a 6% raise, or an 8% raise, that automatically means you get that raise. If it's not collective and you're a lousy teacher, maybe you'll get a 0 and somebody else will get 10%. And so the collective bargaining is what makes the difference. And, you know, reading what FDR said, I remember when I was in school that it became legal to unionize the public sector. And all the teachers all across the country, they were all going on strike for more money. And think about it, you know, you talk about what FDR saying is you can hold the people hostage, and that you're basically attacking the government. I agree with Joshua that it's statist, but at the same time, you've done this thing where all of a sudden the teachers are going, no, we're going on strike, so parents all of a sudden have to figure out what to do with their children that they didn't expect to have to do with. And they would go on strike for 2 or 3 months. And it created all kinds of problems because these were, I mean, as many problems as were created by the trains going on strike, but nobody talks about that because they're public sector employees and the government just negotiates and gives them more money.
And I mean, part of it is you can't fire people for joining a union. You know, because I mean, I don't have as much of a problem with it them being allowed to unionize, but on the other hand, they should be able to be fired for unionizing. Like, okay, you know,
they can be fired for.
We can find new teachers. We're just going to fire you because this is just going to oppress the people.
Reagan did it,
right? Which was considered shocking that he would fire a union, but he did it. But people aren't going to fire. I mean, the politicians aren't going to do it because the other people that are looking, they're going, well, what's he going to do with interest rates? What's he going to do with this? It's only the union members that are saying, is he going to give me 4% or 6%? So it creates this real dichotomy between that you're buying 20% of the vote and the other 80% of the people don't really care. Now it keeps decreasing, which is a good thing, except for the public sector, which just keeps increasing. But unions in general, I mean, they're down so that now there's about as many people in government that are unionized that are private, even though the private sector is about 5 times bigger. Not enough of the American people are willing to say this is just wrong. So, I mean, we should recognize that it's very easy for us to look at America and look at our wealth and think that means we're a very stable country. The reality is we're $32 trillion in debt. We're a very unstable country. And you look at these things and you look at the rise in the growth of the public sector. You look at the growth in the income that for people in the private sector. You know, I think the 5 richest counties are all right around Washington, D.C. because they're
public
all federal.
Sector.
Did I say private?
Yeah.
Private, public, whatever. The public sector employees make so much more that all the 5 counties around D.C. are like the most wealthy counties in the country. I mean, we've got in this situation, and they're the ones that are voting, and they're the ones that will just keep voting more money for themselves.
Right.
And we're in a situation where it looks like a death spiral. It will be interesting to see what God does.
What does Scripture say? If I have decided to do an evil against the people and they turn away from the evil that they've done, I will turn away from the evil thing that I was going to do to them. And so, I mean, it is in the hands of the church. It really is in the hands of the church. It is in the hands of the people of God. Will we turn away from our sin? And I mean, and this is part of the issue, is you can look at how evil the world is, but that evil has infiltrated the church. That we're not as evil as the world is, but it's here. It's come down.
We're making them twice the sons of hell that we are.
Right, and it's close. I mean, it's not. You don't have to look far to find it around yourself in part of your life. It comes into your thinking. There was a part of it where, hey, I mean, I didn't vote for Donald Trump, but I liked the idea of somebody who would make me rich. I think there were a lot of people who there was a big part of it was, he's going to make me wealthy, and I don't care about the other stuff about him. I don't care about his moral issues. I don't care about all these other things. And so, I mean, it really is. There's a sin issue, and the church needs to repent.
And that's why I keep coming back to justice, because it seems to me that that's the area that to solve this problem, to solve a lot of the problems with the government, the church needs to repent about its view of justice.
Yes.
Where it says God doesn't inform justice. We'll do what feels good to us, which is basically the justice that most churches embrace now. Not what does God say is righteous, what does God say is the just thing to do, but what makes us feel good. And as long as you're doing that, you get thrashed around, right? Because Obama does the same thing with kids at the border that Trump did, but they show the pictures differently, or that Biden's doing now. Biden probably has a higher percentage of children that are in cages than Trump ever did, just because there's so many people coming across the border now. But you look and everybody sees that, and that emotionally they get drawn that way instead of actually sitting back and saying, what is the just thing to do? And so now we go, they have to be put out of the cage, and they're sent with basically child traffickers, a lot of them. They're not family. We don't have any way to track to see if they're family. And so we do all these evil things saying that we're doing good things because we don't care about justice. We just care about the feeling of justice, which is how it's gotten us so far in so many of these ways, is that we just want to go, oh, the workers, it's not fair that they have such working conditions. So let's give them power instead of saying, what's the right thing to do? What should the government do? What should we do? And the only ones that can inform the government of that is the church, because we're the pillar and ground of the truth. And so as long as we're not talking about what is just, we can just expect things to get worse. And I don't see many churches talking about what is just.
What are some things that people could do right now? You know, what are the things that people can do in their life? I mean, I can think in the sense of, like, in your church, care about – I mean, stop gossiping about the guy who's bothered you and go and do Matthew 18. Go to him – you know, the guy who's offended you, go to him and actually go through Matthew 18 with him and tell him where he's offended you and love him and care for him and desire to restore him and do this and stop talking bad about – you know, stop – I mean, but there are other things that can be done as well.
There's some really basic ones that have analogs to what we've been talking about with the improper exercise of authority. You know, if unions arise because something needed to be done and the proper authorities weren't doing it, so somebody else stepped in. Well, has that happened in your church? You know, there's work to be done in a church. And there's men who need to be doing a lot of that work. And you know what happens in many churches is the women sit around and say, hey, there's work that ought to be done. You guys aren't doing it, so we're going to do it. And so you have all of these women-led committees and things doing the work of the church. And you have, you know, and this is how you go down the path of ordaining women worship leaders and getting women deacons and all of these kinds of things. And it's not just a church. It's in your house, too, where something needs to be done. You as a husband aren't doing it. Your wife says, well, this thing needs to be done. And instead of waiting and being patient, she just goes and does it. So, you know, there's all...
And it pleases you
which
that
is
she
first,
goes ahead and
which is 1 Peter 3, right? Is right. That she's not supposed to go and do it. That's how you solve the problem
but
in the home.
But it's also what is, you know, it's what is said back in the garden that, hey, this is the way things are going to work.
Right.
This is the problem that's natural to man from the beginning of sin is that the order and the desire of authority is going to be turned on its head. So, you know, if that's what all of the union problem is, then start with those areas where you have authority, exercise that authority. And it's hard to say, you know, because I know there's areas I ought to be exercising authority. I'm not. And
stop provoking your wife to sin against you because, yeah,
right.
Maybe she feels like she's being beaten and no one's being just. And so she says, I'm going to do something about it.
I agree with that at the home. And then you also have to take it out to the church level. How many wives are their husbands not doing the things that they should do and the church remains silent? That's the same thing. Instead of the church going, why aren't you leading the family in devotions? Why aren't you leading your wife? Why aren't you participating in the church? Why aren't you to the man? They just let the woman do everything instead of actually rebuking the man, instead of discipling the man, instead of saying, no, you really have the responsibility. Instead, they go, well, we'll make it easier for the woman to do this, which is what churches do all the time. Instead of saying, let's fix it, they go, you know, for instance, Sunday school. The purpose of Sunday school is parents are not teaching their children the things of God, so therefore churches will establish Sunday school so that we can make sure the children are taught. Instead of saying,
they fixed it.
Let's love the parents enough to go, if you don't want to teach your children the things of God, you're not obeying the greatest commandment. Why do you think you're saved? But it's a lot easier to start a Sunday school than it is to say that. So we see all these structures that the church does where, yeah, we're modeling what the government has done instead of modeling what God says is the righteous thing to do. And we're showing a lot of injustice inside the church. I mean, especially in terms of discipline, it's very uneven. It's very, you know, the wealthy guy tends to get off and the poor guy tends to get abused. I mean, this happens all the time in churches in America. In conservative churches, this happens. So one of the things to do is to make sure that your standards of justice are the same for everybody. Because when you stop doing that, it causes real problems, including the women that are members, including the children that are members, is that all of them have the right to justice. As we consider our society, you know, unions are one aspect of the problem, but there's so many problems with how we deal with welfare, how we deal with the poor, how we deal with you know, the people that are handicapped. I mean, there's just all kinds of things because the church has failed to do what it's supposed to do. The church is to be the light of the world. And part of that light, one of the main things that the light is supposed to do is show what justice is in the world. When the world walks according to its own ways, it will stumble and it will fall and it will run into things. It will be like the drunken man that's staggering in the dark. And that's where America is. And we should recognize whose fault that is. May we be more bold to say, this is what God has said. Thanks for joining us.
This has been The Conquering Truth, a project of Reformation Baptist Church. If you found this helpful, you can visit us online at theconqueringtruth.com and subscribe here or in your favorite podcast app. Thanks for watching.